Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Our first interview is with Gail Hornstein, PhD, professor of psychology at Mount Holyoke College, and author of Agnes's Jacket. She will be the Connect Summit County speaker May 3rd at the Park City Hospital, which begins Mental Health Awareness Month.
And then, switching gears in a most interesting way, we'll speak with internationally recognized clairvoyant counselor, author, and educator, Ellen Tad. We'll talk to Ellen about her teachings, perceptions, and her new book called The Infinite View, a guidebook for life on Earth. This is The Mountain Life. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is Ann McCoyd with Chin McCoyd, Fleming Harris, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. We've loved and supported KPCW since opening day in the Memorial Building in 1980. Real estate's all about community, and KPCW is the source for Park City local news. Our local info is DeerValleyRealEstate.com.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Connect Summit County will present Dr. Gail Hornstein at the Park City Hospital as part of their speaker series. It's on May 3rd. Gail is a professor of psychology at Mount Holyoke College and author of two books addressing mental health issues. She presents a different perspective on mental illness and how the insights of people diagnosed with schizophrenia, with bipolar illness or personality disorder and other mental ailments force us to rethink our fundamental assumptions about madness, treatment, peer support, and patient life. Gail Hornstein, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's a delight to be with you.
Well, thank you. You as well. And so interesting, if we could start with this. You talk about madness. You use the word madness and how it's always fascinated you. And I found that interesting because I don't often come across that word, madness. What is it to you?
Well, I use that word because it's... Although it's an older word and we don't hear it as much as we used to, I think it's a more neutral word because it connects with ordinary people and it doesn't automatically make an assumption about pathology or illness. If we use a word like mental illness, we're automatically assuming that whatever kind of state the person is in is something that is a problem and needs to be gotten rid of or treated in some way by a mental health professional.
Okay, that's good.
That's kind of interesting because the connotation for me of madness is similar to what you described. I mean, madness kind of feels or sounds or impacts me as though it were an illness, a pathology.
Well, that is certainly one way that people can experience it. And in our culture, where that is a framework that has been presented to us, many people do experience difficult states in that way. But people all over the world throughout history have experienced what we can call in a very general way unusual states of mind or extreme emotions or surprising perceptions. And whether or not we consider these to be symptoms of an illness depends a lot on the context that we're in. So to give one example that I talk about a lot in my book, if people hear a voice that others in the room don't hear, that's an experience. It can be inspiring. It can be terrifying. It can be something a person really wants to get rid of. It can be something that they welcome. And if you hear that voice in a spiritual context, or you live in a culture or a subculture where people think that you have a gift to be able to hear voices that others don't hear, then you don't automatically think that's an illness. If you hear it in a context in which that's the framework in which to understand it, and you're frightened by it, then it might make sense to think about it as an illness. But the experience itself doesn't come with a big label around its neck telling you how to think about it.
That is so interesting because, as you probably heard in our introduction, our next guest is actually someone who does hear those voices, and she's a clairvoyant. She has parlayed it into a wonderful career. She's widely published, and she helps
Indeed,
others.
Indeed, I actually know Ellen Tett, and I'm delighted that you've got her as another guest.
Oh, great. So, and this is kind of, you talk about when you were a young student in graduate school getting serious about the study of psychology, you found this disparity between how people with, who heard voices, for example, were talked about and what you found when you read their personal narratives. You were presented with this, they're narcissistic, they're unrelational, you can't get into their psyche. And yet you found that quite the opposite was true. So if you would talk a little bit about that.
Yes, thank you so much for asking about that, because that is indeed how I came to take the views that I take, and what will be the focus of my presentation next week in Park City for my current project called Our Minds and Each Other, Reimagining Mental Health. And that all began when I realized that there were hundreds of people who had written personal accounts of their experiences of what we might call mental illness or madness, every imaginable kind of form of anomalous experience, unusual perceptions, strange thoughts, feelings that other people didn't understand. And I began to collect these first-person narratives, and I was astonished when I discovered how many of them there were. And I now maintain a bibliography that has 1,000 titles on it, and these are just titles that are books that have been published in English. So if you think about how many more accounts there are in other languages or in articles or blogs, there are just hundreds and hundreds of these. And if you read these accounts, which represent people's experience of every possible kind and every possible kind of person from every demographic group and every age, you see that people who have had any kind of unusual mental experience are intensely motivated to understand what is going on in their minds. And this really makes sense. If something strange happens to you, you want to understand it. And so when I began to read these books, I realized that most mental health professionals just didn't know about these, and they didn't take them into account. And so they were often mystified by what was happening to someone who perhaps at that moment couldn't explain it. But if you read these accounts, as I have and I've written about for many years, you realize that people do have completely understandable explanations of what's going on in their minds. We might not all agree with those explanations, just as people from different religious communities, for example, don't necessarily agree with one another's explanations of who is God or how did we all get here. But we understand that there are differing explanations based on people's own experience. And I feel that this is a huge source of insight for those of us who are mental health professionals. And in my current work, where I'm extending these ideas to those of us who don't have a mental illness, who haven't had so many unusual experiences, but still want to understand our own minds in a clearer way.
And so, Gail, when you read those 1,000 accounts, or a portion of those 1,000,
I'll admit I haven't read all 1,000, <Okay. laughs> but I certainly have read hundreds of them.
But you've collected the 1,000,
yes.
And is that where the story of Agnes came from? Was it one of those accounts that you decided to explore more deeply, or how were you drawn to her particular story with your book, Agnes's Jacket?
Well, let me tell your listeners about Agnes Richter, because she's such an extraordinary example of what I'm talking about. And I had been reading these books that were published as books, and I had been meeting with people who have been patients in the mental health system and who have opportunities in peer support groups and other kinds of contexts to talk about their own stories. But I also was interested in people who told their stories in different ways than in words in books. And Agnes Richter was a woman who lived in the 19th century in Germany, and she was a seamstress before she had any kind of mental health difficulties, a very accomplished seamstress. She was paid large sums of money to make beautiful clothes. And she then had some kind of mental health difficulties, and she was put into a mental institution in the 1890s, and unfortunately, she never got out. She was there for more than 25 years, and she died in that institution. But while she was there, she made this extraordinary garment, which is now in a museum in Heidelberg, Germany. And what she did was she took a garment which was given to her to wear. In the 19th century, people who were psychiatric patients had to wear uniforms the way prisoners do. And she took this garment, which was very unflattering, probably, and made out of a very thick kind of linen, and she basically took it apart and restitched it together to make a beautiful jacket. And, you know, that in itself would be admirable. But what makes this jacket stand out, and the reason it's in a museum, is because on the entire surface of the jacket, the inside, the outside, the sleeves, the collar, she stitched a text. She basically told her story in this jacket, on this jacket. And we know that she wore this jacket. There are signs of wear in it. There are perspiration stains. We know that she actually wore this. And on this jacket is an extraordinary text that is the story of her experience. And it, to me, this jacket represents the whole conundrum, the whole problem, the whole dilemma we face when dealing with mental illness or madness, whatever we want to call it, that people have an intense desire to tell their stories, but we can't always understand what those stories mean. And there have been many, many scholars who have studied, as I have, the text on the jacket to try to decode it, and we can read some parts of it, but we can't read the whole thing.
And so when you and the other scholars are looking at that jacket, and I'm sure the doctors who were at the asylum watched Agnes wear this jacket around with all this text in it, that some would view that as a clear sign of illness, of madness. They'd be like, you know, well, there it is. There's Agnes in her crazy jacket walking around the asylum. And then, as you point out, it's, you know, there's a different way of looking at it, which is this an act of a mad person, or is this an act of a person who, you know, is obsessively attempting to tell her story and to understand herself? It's an act of creativity. It's an act of, I mean, you could build a very powerful counter narrative, which would, you know, be just the opposite from mental illness.
You know, Tim, I'm so glad that you used that term counter-narrative, because that's a term that I find very, very helpful in thinking about this, because, you know, what are narratives? They're stories. And I don't mean story in the sense of something that's fiction. I just mean story in the sense of, you know, we all tell the stories of our lives. We make sense of what's happened to us. We say to someone else, gee, I've had this unusual experience. Help me understand it. And if you're a person like Agnes Richter, who is locked into a mental institution, who cannot get out, she was in an institution at a time when she could not write letters to other people. They would not have been sent. If she had some other means of keeping a diary, it probably would have been confiscated from her. And so I do think it's an act of extraordinary creativity that she took her talent for sewing, which, as I say, she had developed. She wasn't put in the institution until she was in her 40s, so she had been sewing for many years. And she put that to work in the service of this creativity and created her story in a form that couldn't so easily be taken away from her. It was on her body. It was almost like a tattoo.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Gail Hornstein. She's the author of the book Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. And Gail will be here in Park City next week, a week from today, on May 3rd at 6:30 p.m., speaking at the Park City Park City Hospital, there we go, as part of the Connect Summit County May Mental Health Awareness Month. And looking really forward to your talk next week. But I'm so interested. You tell a lot of these stories in your book, Gail. And one of those is a story about a woman named Patsy, who is perhaps schizophrenic or being diagnosed and in the throes of being diagnosed as schizophrenic. And her therapist, Marius Rome, this is in the Netherlands, they're speaking, and she is sort of yelling at him, saying, let's forget about whether or not I have schizophrenia. I want to deal with these voices. And she says to him, why do you believe in a God you cannot see, but you call the voices that I hear every day unreal? And that is a very interesting point, I think. Talk about that story.
Well, that story launched an entire international movement, so it's a very, very powerful story. What happened, in brief, is that Marius Rome, this psychiatrist in the Netherlands, to his credit, listened to his patient asking this powerful question: why do you believe in something you can't see? He was a religious person. He believed in God. He didn't have any concrete evidence of that. And Patsy heard terrifying voices that were tormenting her. And she wanted him to take seriously the fact that she was hearing them. It wasn't really a question of whether he could also hear them. It was a question of him believing that she heard them. And when he started to do that, when he started and had a very, very interesting sort of idea, which was to get Patsy together with other people who heard voices, other patients in the hospital where she was, because he felt frustrated at his inability to help her. And he thought, well, I know this sounds like a crazy idea, but what if people who hear voices got together and talked to other people who hear voices? And that, which happened about 27 years ago, was the launch moment for something that now exists all over the world called the Hearing Voices Network, HVN. The Hearing Voices Network is a collaboration all over the world of mental health professionals like myself and Marius Rome, people who hear voices from many, many different cultures, family members of people who hear voices, and other people who want to contribute to creating a different way of thinking about this kind of experience. And from Patsy's moment of talking to several other patients, which turned out to be hugely helpful to her, an organized movement of peer support groups that are sponsored by the Hearing Voices Network and which I have helped to bring to the United States, now is providing an alternative to the standard approach to thinking about these kinds of experiences. And people who go to HVN peer support groups are very, very diverse. Some of them continue to be treated by mainstream psychiatrists. They continue to take medication or use other methods of trying to help them. Some of them do not. Some of them stop hearing their voices after they've been in some of these groups for a while. Some of them continue to hear their voices, but they hear them in a more positive way. People who hear voices often hear multiple voices, some of which are terrifying and some of which are more helpful. And part of what the peer support groups do is to help people get the more positive voices to be stronger and the more negative voices to be less strong, much the way if you were being bullied at school, for example, you might want to learn how to stand up to the bully. Not that you should yourself become a bully, but you might want to be able to say to the bully, you know, you're saying I'm a terrible person and I don't have any friends and no one will ever like me or play with me, but you know what? That's not true. Billy likes me and I've made a friend in him. And, you know, some kind of a response that changes the relationship between the bully and the person being bullied. That's often how people feel.
That's fascinating. Wow. So I'm wondering, in all of your research and your study and your exposure to this world, I mean, it does sound like it could be a bit controversial. I mean, the people hearing, I'm sorry, what's the network called again?
Hearing Voices Network,
HVN. Okay, Hearing Voices Network in and of itself could be quite controversial, because what most of these people, or the people who are affected by hearing voices, I would imagine their loved ones and their families, want the voices to go away. They don't want to recognize it as, oh, the possibility of enlightenment. And so, I don't know, address that if you would.
You know, it's interesting, Lynn, and I'm glad you asked that question, because, of course, new ideas are often controversial until they're more widely accepted. And they're more controversial here in the United States than they are in many other places. Let me give you an example. In Britain, which is the place where the Hearing Voices Network is most well established and is now, if not mainstream, a very widely accepted part of the standard mental health system, and where the media often present this perspective as a completely acceptable one. For example, my colleagues in the Hearing Voices Network in Britain are next week, in fact, I think the day before I will be in Park City, they will be appearing on the BBC's flagship television magazine called Horizon. They're having an entire program in which the leaders of the Hearing Voices Network in Britain are presenting their viewpoint in a very standard, kind of acceptable way. And the Horizon BBC producers sent them out to interview psychiatrists rather than the other way around. So in Britain, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, in Australia, all these perspectives are much more widely accepted by the standard mental health system. They're new in the United States, and so they are more controversial, like all new approaches are. But I travel all around the country, along with my colleagues in this work, and we present these ideas. We train people to be facilitators of these peer support groups, and we get a tremendous amount of interest all over the United States. We cannot keep up with the demand for the training of these facilitators and with opportunities to talk about these new approaches. And that's where the talk that I'll be giving next week, which is called Our Minds and Each Other, is focused on how to take these ideas and apply them, even if you yourself have not been diagnosed with a mental illness or someone in your family has not, but how to think about these ideas as they pertain to all of us, because we all have puzzling aspects of our minds. We all want to better understand our friends and relatives and to make sense of what happens in the extremely complex world of our psychology.
Gail, I'm really curious about a number of things that you just raised in my mind with that comment, but where this, the idea that people hear voices, you know, I mean, where do you stand on that? People, well, no, I'm not going to ask that, because let's just assume that people hear voices, and I think that's what you're saying, and that's been more widely accepted in other societies and other areas of the world, and we're resistant to that, and it's a new concept here in the United States. But to use Ellen Tadd, our next guest, as an example, what has happened to allow her to be viewed as a clairvoyant and to embrace the voices that she hears versus being labeled as having madness or an illness or a mental health issue? And is it a societal perception of the person, or is it something else? And kind of where do you stand on that, about people who hear voices and how we label them or judge them or perceive them?
You know, that is such a fantastic question, and it really gets at some of the core issues here. So first of all, let me say that the reason we use the term hearing voices rather than the term that, say, a psychiatrist might use of auditory hallucinations is that if you use a word like hallucination, you're automatically assuming that there is something wrong with the person and that the perception that they're having is false. That's what hallucination means. If you look it up in the dictionary, it means false perception.
Right.
So once somebody is considered to have a hallucination, then the whole focus of those who are around them is on saying to them, that's not really happening. You're not really hearing that voice. I can't hear it. You're not hearing it. But of course, we know that things that are happening in someone else's mind or even someone else's body. Like I'm talking to you right now on a telephone. I can't tell whether you're having a headache, whether you had something that disagreed with you at breakfast, whether any other kind of thing. And so when we use the term hearing voices, we use it because it's more neutral and it describes what's actually happening, whether those voices are good or bad, whether we want to get rid of them or not, whether they're a source of insight or a terrifying pathology. We don't assume. It could be any of those things. And a person like Alan Tadd is an example of a person who, first of all, has a very different kind of relationship with her voices. Her voices aren't bullies. Her voices aren't telling her to do things that she doesn't want to do. And a person who might end up, say, with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, who hears voices that are terrifying, are they really having a different experience, or are they having a different relationship to the same kind of experience? That's our question. And I think that if you ask me where I stand on this, I'll tell you, the thing that I've learned the most in 40 years of studying these kinds of experiences is an attitude of humility, an attitude that says the mind is extraordinarily complicated, and we don't understand a lot of what happens in it. We have a lot of terminology that we use to describe it. We have neuroscience. We have abnormal psychology. We have a lot of different frameworks. But we still don't really understand. And I think if we listen to people who are having experiences that are challenging to them, we can learn a huge amount. And I sometimes make the comparison, you know, people who have physical illnesses like cancer or AIDS or heart disease, who write a narrative about their experience and how they got through it and what they learned from it, we often consider those people in our culture to be admirable. We celebrate people who survive cancer, especially if they go on to do inspiring things. But people who survive a mental health crisis and come out better on the other side are faced with still so much stigma in the culture about mental illness that they're not going to be standing up in public and saying, I used to be diagnosed as schizophrenic. Now I'm wearing a T-shirt and I'm in a 5K road race to celebrate my working through this and getting out to the other side. We don't look upon people in that way. And I think it's very, I applaud your having Alan Tadd and other people who have had unusual experiences, but don't necessarily see them as pathological.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that because Alan Tadd is part of the same conversation. And the focus of a lot of the work and a lot of the stories is always about people who are having that challenging relationship with the voices they hear versus having that wonderful and acceptant and you know, positive message relationship that they want to share with the rest of the world as a clairvoyant. And so it's part of the same equation of relationship. And I wanted to ask you, why does the focus, I guess the focus always ends up on the challenge, because when you're challenged, you're looking for answers and a way to move through that challenge.
Yes, and that's really an opportunity. That's really what my work is all about, because you'd have to ask Alan Tadd, but I'm sure she would say she has had challenges in trying to make sense of these kinds of experiences that she now is able to use in a positive way. And I've studied other people who hear what we might call spiritual voices. They hear voices in a context in which other people around them, say in their church group, will say to them, you're hearing the voice of God. That's a wonderful thing. Yeah. Now, a person can still be frightened by that. Think of all the religious leaders through history, Muhammad, Moses. You know, those were people who were hiding behind bushes saying to God, don't single me out. You know, Muhammad tried very hard to get God not to pick him out as someone to speak to. It can be awe-inspiring. It can be terrifying. And even if, let's bring in the role of trauma here, because many people who end up with a diagnosis of schizophrenia are not hearing the voice of God. They're hearing a version of the voice of the person who sexually abused them. or they're hearing a version of the voice of someone who bullied them. And that voice is keeping that trauma alive in their mind until such time as they can work through it.
Yeah.
And so part of what we say in the Hearing Voices Network is voices are messengers. Sometimes they bring a bad message. Sometimes they bring a helpful message. But you know the old expression, don't shoot the messenger. So getting rid of the voice itself is not the solution. The question is understanding, why is that voice there? Why has this person's mind gone in this particular way to create this kind of sensation? What meaning does it have? What can the person learn from it? And in the Hearing Voices Network, people often learn something useful, even about a terrifying voice, and then it becomes less terrifying or it goes away.
Mm. Boy, this is such an interesting conversation. I'm so glad you'll be coming to Park City next week. Our guest is Dr. Gail Hornstein. She's a professor of psychology at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Her book is called Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. She's also a facilitator for the Hearing Voices Network in this country. And Gail, thank you so much for joining us. We'll look forward to your talk next week.
Thank you both. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners and look forward to seeing many of them next week.
All right. Thanks, Gail. And she also has a website, gailhornstein.com.
Yep.
And just to mention here, Connect Summit County has a couple dozen different talks going on in May Mental Health Awareness Month. May 2nd, it kicks off at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Park City with the University of Utah Mental Health Research Showcase, investigating the brain, informing clinical practice to enhance patient outcomes. And then the following day, of course, May 3rd, at the Blair Conference Center at Park City Hospital, Gail Hornstein will be speaking, and her talk is called Our Minds and Each Other, Reimagining Mental Health. Again, a week from today at 6:30 p.m.
And that's free. I think all of their speaking series, they're free, are they not?
All open to the general public. Admission is free unless otherwise noted. You can go to connectsummitcounty.org for the full schedule. And wow, they really do a great job in illuminating the topic of mental health here in Summit County and all over, of course. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. I can't wait till this next conversation.
What a tie-in.
With Ellen Tad. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Gail Hornstein, author of the book Agnes's Jacket. Again, she'll be in Park City next week, a week from today, speaking at the Park City Hospital as part of the May Mental Health Awareness Month. And now, what happens when you're inhabited by a spirit guide, when you channel messages from an unseen consciousness and are visited by your deceased mother? With our next guest, clairvoyant counselor, educator, and author Ellen Tad, will explore these ideas. Ellen Tad, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's so fascinating. I can't believe what a coincidence it is that we were just speaking with Gail Hornstein, who also lives in Massachusetts and is familiar with your work. And we were talking to her about the Hearing Voices Network, and we were saying how interesting that in some people, hearing voices is part of their diagnosed schizophrenia, and it's not a good thing. And then, you know, reading your story about how you began to hear voices that were very enlightened, and you have turned it into this wonderful teaching experience, educating others and illuminating, as you do in your book, The Infinite View.
Yes. Well, you know, the spiritual world I often think of it as a layer cake. There are many different levels of existence. And I always tell people there are as many different kinds of dead people as there are alive people. And so when you're having a conversation with a person in the grocery store, it can be an enlightening conversation or it can be a horrible conversation. So what's important is to differentiate who you're talking to and the quality of the information.
Right. And let's start sort of with your history for hearing voices. You grew up as this very sensitive child. You may have heard voices at different times, or you may have just been ultra sensitive. You kind of take us through this journey with your upbringing. And then when it's all tipped on its head, as you do encounter another person who is clairvoyant, I believe.
Yes. So I write about the fact that I was raised by my father, who was a physicist. So I grew up in an academic environment and in a scientifically oriented household. And when I had experiences such as seeing faces in the dark, seeing light around people, I said to my father, I can see molecules. And, you know, this was a word I had learned from him. And he actually was very kind, and he took me to an electron microscope and showed me what molecules look like. And, you know, there's an echo. Do you hear an echo on the...
No, we hear you loud and clear.
Okay, well, then I'll just ignore it. I felt very confused as a child. When I would talk to other people about my unusual experiences, they thought I was making up stories. And, you know, I grew up with a mother who had a severe case of MS, and so I thought for a long time something was probably wrong with me. But my mother died when I was 17, and then my brother's girlfriend at the time ended up being a trance medium, and she went into trance for my mother. And I was a skeptic, but I could see my mother's face superimposed over hers. And my mother said certain things to me that this woman did not know. And without a doubt, it was my mother. I was totally convinced. And it was my watershed event where I then learned there is life after death. But even more important than that, my mother's message, which was, do not mourn for me. She had a very difficult life, and she said, do not mourn for me. I chose my difficult life to learn compassion. And she said, no matter how things appear, if you look deeply, you'll see there are always reasons. And that was an incredible message to receive. And after that, I stopped fighting my sensitivity. And then I started having a lot of clairvoyant and clairaudient experiences. But, you know, my academic upbringing made me more interested in wanting to talk to the philosophers of the spiritual world than people's dead relatives, even though talking to my deceased mother is what transformed my life.
Ellen, before we get into the messages and the messengers from that spiritual realm that you connect with. I'd like to ask you a question that actually Gail Hornstein suggested that we ask you, because we were talking with her about, you know, the challenges that people have in their relationship with the voices, and then, or just the relationship. Some can be challenging and some can be very beneficial and positive. And we were speaking about you in terms of that beneficial and positive relationship. So your ears should be ringing, because you came up a number of times in our previous interview. But my interest is, did you face challenges? Did you ever question yourself and wonder why you were hearing voices or seeing molecules or seeing auras around people? Or were you willing to be open to it? And or did it ever present a significant challenge in your life?
Well, it definitely was a challenge when I was young, before I had the experience with my mother. But once I had that awakening with my mother and I was young, I was 19, I really felt very quickly that my sensitivity was a gift rather than a problem. And I figured out that I had to learn to meditate in order to start to interpret the experiences that were happening to me. And I discovered that I was a natural meditator, and it was through meditation that I began to sort out my experiences. And I approached my experiences in a very methodical way. When I would have an insight or a vision, I didn't assume that I was accurate. I would simply observe life and look for confirmation. But, you know, the beings that came to me and I could see them and converse with them at the very beginning, you know, were full of light and wisdom, and they had a kind of beauty that was just so worthy of trust that then I stopped being anxious and really totally went with it.
Well, from your experience and having those messages of light and beauty, which were, I guess, easier to embrace, and so you were open to a positive relationship, you were given positive feedback in a loop, and therefore you developed a very beneficial relationship with your voices. What do you think of people who aren't able to do that and are confronted with that challenging side of the equation and then get diagnosed as schizophrenic or bipolar or mentally ill?
So at this stage in my life, I have been a teacher for quite a long time, and I often teach people that I call sensitives in an insensitive world. And I train people how to use their sensitivity in positive and constructive ways. And so when I'm teaching people, I make it clear that there's a need to cultivate positivity. What makes people vulnerable to negativity, to possession, to all of those types of things is a weak will or not cultivating positivity. I like the phrase, positivity is our greatest protection. So before I teach people to access guides, they learn to meditate, they learn to understand the power of attitudes, cultivating positive attitudes. So there's a rigorous training first that helps people to learn to aspire to the highest.
Wow. So, you know, taking aside maybe those diagnosed with mental illness and just looking at the average person, you know, I've read quite a bit on those people who, you know, you use a bunch of different words, clairvoyance, channel, you know, transmedium. But what about the average person who doesn't know, like you hear this voice and you don't know if it's your intuition, your ego, the voice of, you know, your friend who told you what you ought to be doing with your life, you know, last week. I think it's so common. Like, I would love to trust my intuition, but I don't know if it's my intuition. Is it a voice? Is it a guide? So where do you go there?
It's a great question. I actually avoid the word intuition because I call that an umbrella term. It's too broad for me.
Okay.
I'm interested in teaching people to be specific, know where the information is coming from, and pay attention to accuracy and inaccuracy. I use the term a bing and a thud. What's accurate resonates, what isn't accurate doesn't. And so when people talk about following their intuition, it's too vague for me. So in my trainings with people, I help them learn to differentiate what is the voice from within and the qualities that are linked to that. What does it feel like to get guidance externally? What does it feel like to be overly influenced by the perspective of somebody else? These different forms of perception and subtle experiences have very different qualities when you learn the language of subtlety.
Okay, I like that. So you, in your book, it's sort of the same outline that you have used, that you've taught many times. You initially came to this outline of all these different lessons. You talk about one day you were driving in Amherst, I believe, and you had a voice come to you and took you through what the outline for this course would be. Talk about that.
Well, actually, the course was presented to me as it unfolded. So I started teaching, and on the way to the first class, I was told what the class would be focused on. And on the way to the second class, I was told what the class would be focused on. So it unfolded before me, and in that, but I did ask that the course be focused on how to integrate spiritual awareness into everyday life, because I had known people who had genuine, powerful spiritual experiences, but their lives weren't working well. And I was really interested most in integration, how to live what I think of as a multidimensional life, where we're able to have access to a spiritual perspective, but also be practical human beings who parent well and manage our money and take care of our health. So I was really, you know, I love to quote my son. When he was in high school, he said, living the human condition from the human perspective is a tragedy. Living the human condition from the spiritual perspective is really interesting.
Ellen, the term spiritual versus multidimensional, is there a real close association? Are they synonymous, or is it are they quite different? Because I hear you referring to the spiritual world, and I'm assuming that your guides and the voices and the information that you get comes from, does it come from another dimension, or does it come from the spiritual world, and is the spiritual realm one of those multi-dimensions?
Yes, it's one of those multi-dimensions. So when I think of a spiritual perspective, what that means to me is that we're all spirit and we're all human, and that life is bigger than just the material world existence. It also has other dimensions which are spiritual. You know, I talk in my book about clairvoyantly watching my son incarnate and meeting him in etheric form, and then, of course, having a physical baby that grows up into a man. So it's really the recognition that life is much bigger than what we've been taught in school it is.
And do you think that your experience, how unique is it? I mean, you know, you talk about sensitives living in an insensitive world, and you are having a very special relationship with this other dimension. And there are a lot of people who speak of other dimensions. There's the physical dimension, the mental dimension, the emotional dimension, the spiritual dimension, the energetic dimension. And I know people who have very special and intimate relationships with those dimensions. I don't. I'm open to them, and I like talking about them and learning things from them. But why is it that you are connected so deeply and so intimately with another dimension?
Well, to me, our past lives really helps to explain the question why. For example, when my brothers and I were growing up, we all took music lessons. But my oldest brother excelled and eventually became a professional musician. He had so-called the gift. Well, when I look at his past lives, I see that he developed the ability to be an accomplished musician in many lives. So a gift is really something that's been developed in other lives. So when I look at my past lives, often in my sensitivity, I tended to be a hermit and stay connected to the spiritual world rather than blending with a cultural conditioning. And you know, little children have lots of spiritual experiences and clairvoyant experiences, but it gets conditioned out of them because as children, we're taught to perceive life a certain way. And as I wrote in my book, what we focus on is what we see. And so it impacts our experience and the quality of our perception.
Huh. The book is The Infinite View. It's a guidebook for life on Earth. Our guest is Ellen Tad. And Ellen, I know you live in the Boston area now, and you do see people individually, and I think your website says you've seen about 30,000 people since 1975, yes, talking to them about their past lives and things like that. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I usually start when I work with someone at the past life level because I want to ask, who are you? Why have you incarnated? What are you here learning and offering? I find that looking at the past lives really helps to clarify what are our fundamental lessons, what are our contributions. We're a sum total of all that we have been, and that helps us to explain why we have the fears we have and why we have the aspirations we have.
And do people contact you? I mean, how would somebody from Park City, Utah say, engage with you and benefit from your counseling?
Well, I do work over the phone. I've been quite busy promoting The Infinite View, so I haven't been as available for private sessions. But I work with people all over the country and all over the world over the phone, and then I also work with people in person. And I, you know, want very much to help people to develop their own talents and their own skills in expanding their perception, because to me this is an extrasensory perception. It's just an expansion of perception. And having taught a lot of people, when people are taught how to look and how to listen in different ways, they start to expand the quality of their experiences.
That's so nice. I want to just read before we let you go the one of the first pages of your book, and this is a quote from A Guide. You say, "Do not be caught in the limited perspective of life, for it has continual turmoil and uncertainty. If you venture deeper, you will see that there is a growth plan in operation for all individuals. Go deep within the silence of your own being, and when you have heard, carry it through to completion with the full acceptance and knowledge of the infinite perspective of growth and evolution. Your world is rapidly changing, so begin now this listening, for it will be of greater need in the future." Wow, that's fun. I actually sent that, took a picture of that and sent it to my son last night. I like that. Ellen Tad.
You read it beautifully.
Well, thank you. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, it's The Infinite View, a guidebook for life on Earth. Very interesting conversations.
Some people say today. There are no coincidences. It's all synchronicity. And having those two interviews that we didn't know were going to be so closely related is quite interesting.
Yes.
Quite a synchronicity
there,
Lynn Werbeek.
That's right, Tim Annie. Synchronous. Okay, we want to thank our underwriters, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
And Phil Davidson Orthopedics.
And you've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for national news.